Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
So my friend said that that was how he likes to fly, because it means you don't really have to do a lot of work. You just sit there, relax, chat, have a banana, listen to some music and all of those fun things. And he said that there's something that sort of stuck in my head a little bit when he said, this is the best way to fly. You're just sitting there doing nothing and you can see the money going into your account.
Right.
Hello and welcome to Extended, your aerospace radio station.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson and welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Artyom Liss is a UK qualified general aviation pilot and was host of the fabulous programme 2000 Feet. I lost touch with Artyom a few years ago and then read his amazing post about delivering a Piper Saratoga from the UK to Lithuania. I had to find out so much more about this adventure and how it turned out in the end. So, Artyom, welcome to Extended.
Thank you. Very good to be talking to you again, Peter, after all those years.
Yeah, we sort of lost touch. You went abroad for a bit, and I don't know quite what happened there, but I saw your post on Facebook, and I was fascinated to find out a bit more. But just to put it into context, Artyom, can you just tell us about your flying experience and what your qualifications are and what you've been doing most recently?
Certainly. I've been flying for the last 20 years or so, started out in gliders. Then learned to fly microlights at a fabulous place in southern Portugal, where Jerry Breen, one of the giants of the microlight industry, had a school near a little town called Blagos. So that was where I took my first part flights. And then I came back to the UK, and then life sort of got in the way, as it does for most of us.
Yeah.
Family, work, and things like that. So I didn't come back to flying until about 5-6 years ago. And again, I went down the microlight route only because I think microlights are such enormous fun.
Yeah.
But moving on from the
why is that? Why are microlights so much fun? What do you find in them that's different from, you know, fixed wing and the sort of aircraft we're going to get to talk about?
I think to me the main difference is that people in the microlight world don't really take themselves terribly seriously. If you saw somebody wearing a white shirt with epaulettes at the microlight airfield, then 99% of the time, there'll be somebody who just landed in a Cessna 152 after an engine failure.
Right, okay.
But also the airplanes themselves are generally really nice to fly. They're really responsive. They're really light on the controls. And they can do so much for, you know, a quarter of you would expect to pay for a bigger GA airplane. So I just think, you know, a lot of my flying now is aerobatic, and a lot of it is in a fabulous, fabulous machine called the Cap 10. With the Tiger Club, I think one of the best aeroplanes ever, really.
Okay.
But the way it handles and the way you sort of fly it with really just your little finger on the stick, that to me is how the best of microlights fly.
Right, okay. And how long have you had your license for then? And what licenses do you actually hold, Artyom?
Oh, gosh, okay. So I've got a UK NPPL and a UK PPL. I've got an EASA PPL and I've got an FAA PPL. And also a Russian license from when I was working. So that was years ago before Mr. Putin went mad. When I was working in Russia for the BBC, I got myself a Russian license as well. So quite a collection.
Right. Now, I can't let that one go. We did a program a few weeks ago about somebody who went to Siberia just after the fall after the fall of the wall, and he talked about flight in Russia at the time. What was it like when you were learning to fly in Russia?
Well, one big, important, huge caveat is that it was 17 years.
Yeah. No, I understand.
It was a very different world, and it was a very different country. So the airfield at which our club was based was a military airfield, sort of common use, right. I think we call them, where we had a corner of the field to ourselves. But then other than that, it was big military transport, Ilyushin 76s, those sorts of machines.
Wow.
At the time, GA in Russia was very limited, and it was in its infancy, let's be honest with it. And a lot of the background on which it developed and on which it built was sort of ex-military, you know, a bit like our air cadets. So what it meant for people like us in the GA world was if you wanted to go from A to B, you had to submit a request a certain number of days in advance. That request was sometimes granted, sometimes it wasn't. So there's, at the time, there was nothing like our just sort of bimbling in Class G airspace as we do in other parts of the world. But having said that, it was and remains a very tightly knit community. Some of my best friends I met through flying in Russia, and I'm still in touch with them. I flew out of an airfield just outside Moscow where we had a couple of motor gliders, Dimonas, and we had a Katana and a 172, which was destroyed by one of our instructors.
As you do.
I think the world has really moved on. The world has really changed. And, you know, there's a whole separate program to be done about flying in Russia and how it's all been sent underground, how it's all sort of slightly shady zone of flying. But 17 years ago, you could really sense the energy. You could really sense that it was something that was up and coming.
Yeah. Well, thanks for that. I didn't know that at all. So that's an interesting piece. So I think people listening have got a bit of a flavour for your experience. They've probably got a bit of a flavour for the sorts of things you like doing. Let's then talk about this rather crazy idea of delivering a Saratoga from the UK to Lithuania. How in the goodness did that come about?
You know, I think it's crazy for people like you and I, and it's crazy for most other UK PPLs and indeed European PPLs. For people who do this day in, day out as a job, it's no more crazy than, you know, for you and me to drive down to Tesco and pick up some groceries, really.
Yeah.
I worked in Lithuania for a couple of years during COVID, and I met this wonderful guy there, Kestutis Pakarpis, who's become my best friend. I think I can say that confidently. And he flies Airbuses as his day job.
Yep.
On top of that, he's an instructor, you know, like most of them are. He's an instructor, he's a glider pilot. The only bit where we are different is that he hates aerobatics and he doesn't like flying upside down. Other than that, I think, you know, we're very, very compatible, put it this way.
Yeah.
And as I said, we've become best friends. So he was asked to ferry that aeroplane from the UK to Lithuania. And he just messaged me and he asked me if I fancied coming along. And it's one of those things where you don't really say no.
Yeah. It's an opportunity. It certainly is. Now, it's about 1,500 miles, something like that?
It's about that. Yeah, we did about 1,500 miles. You're right. You can, so if you go direct, if you go through Belgium and the Netherlands, you can cut the corner.
Yeah.
We couldn't do that because the airplane we were flying, its transponder was a Mode Charlie, not a Mode Sierra. And the Belgians don't let anybody without Mode Sierra into their airspace.
Right.
So we had to. Because
the route that you eventually took, you flew predominantly southeast and then northeast, sort of, towards Lithuania. I was wondering why that was. So that's interesting. But how did you go about setting this up? Because you flew, your starting point's Leon Solon, which for those who don't know, that's an airfield close to my heart, by the way. It was the first airfield I ever flew in a small aircraft when it was still a military base. But moving on, so that was your starting point. And obviously, Lithuania was where the aircraft was going. How does one go about planning a trip like that?
I think a key consideration was weather. There's no surprise in that. And in fact, for Kęstutis, picking the right weather window has been absolutely at the front of his mind.
Yeah.
Of course, we could go IFR. Of course, we could just sit in cloud and you know look at the autopilot.
Yeah.
And pretty much ignore the weather. But that's, would it have been wise? I don't know. I don't think so. Especially not in an airplane that's new to you.
Yeah.
So we looked at where weather was expected to be best. We looked at the weather window that we thought would work best. And the combination of you have to avoid Belgium and the Netherlands, so you have to go via France. You have to pick up some fuel along the way because it's a big old trip. And you have to find the right weather for you to fly. That sort of guided us, and that really created the route for us.
And was there a lot of work in the flight planning, or was it relatively simple?
I think I'll be honest with you. My friend was doing all the hard work because he is appropriately licensed.
Yeah, I understand.
And he can do all of that. And, you know, I don't have even an IR or IMC in old money, let alone CPL. So he was really doing all of that. But the way he did it is pretty much how we do when we plan our flights from, you know, Duxford to Northfield or something.
Yeah.
Most of it was driven by ForeFlight. Most of it was also driven by various pieces of weather software.
Right.
And of course, the no terms. So his original idea was to go direct. I then, only because I'd heard from somebody who'd attempted a similar flight, I'd heard from them that I'd heard from them that you had to have Mode Sierra to fly in Belgium. So I warned him about that, and we rerouted. But frankly, it may sound onerous. It's nowhere near as onerous as going from, you know, America to Britain, as so many ferry pilots do.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, it's a four flight point to point to point.
And I think that's what came through on your story when you wrote it. I was genuinely heartened, actually, by the ease at which you could do this. It really opened my eyes, because when I started reading it, I was like, wow, I bet Artyom's been planning this for months. I bet he studied his maps. I bet he's done this. I bet he's done all his weights and balance. But as you go through it, you know, we'll touch on some of the things, but he'd never flown a Saratoga before, had he?
No, he hadn't. And it was one of those weird coincidences. I don't even know how many thousands of hours he now has.
Yeah.
He's flown everything from, you know, tiny little microlights of the thruster ilk all the way to his A320. And he's just never come across a Saratoga before.
Yeah. It's just bizarre. I had in my head, even from my PPL days, that you had to go through your familiarization, your sign off, you know, before anyone would let you go. But he read the pilot operating handbook online. You know, you had a hard copy. I'm not trying to be flippant, but he sort of checked it out, got his numbers, got his stats in his head, and he said, let's go.
That's exactly how it worked. So the day before we set off, we took the aeroplane up just for an hour and a half, 2 hours. Just to see how she flies, just to get used to her, to do a couple of ILS approaches at Bournemouth, a few stalls, just to see what it's like.
Yeah.
And, yeah, really, all there was to it. He'd read the PPL. He'd read the POH on the internet. He then cross-checked it against the hard copy when we arrived at the airfield. And I have this photograph, which maybe some people might have seen on Facebook, of him just sitting on the wing of the Saratoga in his yellow T-shirt, just leafing through the POH. So he'd read through that, and then he said, okay, let's jump in and go.
Yeah. It stunned me. But you got your familiarization. Did you get a little bit of handling before you set off?
Yes. So we both did about half an hour each, I think.
Right.
Of just hand flying the aeroplane above the Isle of Wight, which incidentally allowed me to show him the needles and all the beautiful parts, you know, all the beautiful bits of the Isle of Wight, and to say, look, down there is sand down. Don't land there unless you really want to be abused. No, just kidding, Dan. If you're listening to this, no hard feelings. So we did about half an hour of hand flying each, then did a few approaches into Bournemouth, a couple of ILSs, figured out that the autopilot was producing a right-hand turn, whatever you did to it. So obviously there was something that wasn't quite right with the autopilot. Landed back at Leon Sol and spoke to the mechanics who worked for the guy that sold us the aeroplane. Spoke to the mechanics who worked for the guy that sold the aeroplane to the owner. So they sorted that out. Was something really minor. And then, the next morning we were ready to go.
Right. So off you set. We've talked a little bit about the route. Did you feel a little bit apprehensive? How did you feel getting going? Was it exciting? Because it is quite a big aircraft and, you know, it's quite spacious. It's quite heavy, I think.
It's a 2-ton aeroplane, which is what? Twice as heavy as the heaviest aeroplane I'd flown before, which was, you know, nothing special, a 172, but it's twice as heavy as that. Inside, it's really, really, really big. You've got room for six. Obviously, it can't carry six because of the weight and balance.
Yeah.
But you've got room for six with club seating, so people sit face to face. You don't rub shoulders in the cockpit. There's just tons of room. The way it flies, you can feel that it's heavy. It's kind of really ponderous. And in the aeroplanes that I generally fly, whether it's the Cap 10 or the Microlights or that motor glider in the group to which I belong, you generally fly with your fingertips. With that, you have to really use both hands, and you can't get away with just having one hand on the controls. That's not how this aeroplane flies. This is something you get used to, but it's just something to bear in mind. I think for people like us, there's a massive difference. There's a world of difference. For people who fly professionally and for whom it's a job, it's, you know, you and I can jump from a Mazda into a BMW into a Toyota into a transit van.
Yeah.
We'd be okay. I think it's a similar sort of approach.
Okay. So you routed out of Leon Sol and along the English south coast and then towards Dover. Quite busy. How were the roles split up between how you were handling and operating the aircraft?
Well, on the first leg, my friend was doing all the flying. I was monitoring and I was doing the radio, partly because he'd never flown in Britain before. He doesn't know our quirks, and our radio is quirky, as I think everybody knows. Basic service, traffic service, passing the message and all of that sort of stuff. So he was flying, I was doing the radio and I was monitoring and really just looking out the window.
And did you study the pilot operating handbook to know what the T's and P's were and what the right ranges were and things like that?
Oh, yes, of course. I approached it the way any PPL would approach something like that. I read the POH about a million times. I had the key numbers all memorized. So it's a different world.
Did you know that during the Falklands War in 1982, there was a plan to put the Black Buck raids on steroids by sending an Avro Vulcan to bomb airfield targets on mainland Argentina, potentially returning to RAF Waddington the long way round via Chile, Easter Island, Tahiti, Hawaii, the USA and Canada? Did you also know that during the Second World War, a proposal was made to build B-29 superfortresses in the UK, powered by Bristol Centaurus engines? If your answers to the above are yes, you're probably a regular reader of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal, print and digital, that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. If your answers are no, visit theaviationhistorian.com and see what you're missing.
And you departed in British airspace over the English Channel, and then you started climbing towards your cruise altitude?
That's right. I think as soon as we got out into France, we just started going up and up, really. because with these airplanes, the higher they fly, of course, the faster, well, with any airplane, but especially with the big touring machines.
Yeah.
The faster you fly, the more economical it is, the faster you go. So, the, you know, it's benefits all round, really. And we ended up cruising at about 6,500 feet.
Right. And this isn't a pressurized aircraft, is it?
It's not pressurized, no.
No. Okay. So you needed to stay relatively comfortable in terms of the top end of the cruise.
You wouldn't want to go above 10,000 feet, 12,000 feet, but 7,000 was absolutely fine.
Yeah.
The one slight issue we had was that the heater wasn't working, which makes life a little bit more interesting at those sorts of heights. But
now that, yeah, there was it's a bit interesting that story though, isn't it? Because your colleague said to you, you know, just let me know if your fingernails start going blue. You know, how cold was it up there?
Well, at 6,500 feet, it was okay. It was about maybe +8, +10.
Okay.
It's on the second leg when we went even higher and we went up to 9,000 feet. That's when it became really quite a bit of an issue.
Let's come to that, because I think at this point when you were cruising over France, I think in your story you talk about, do you know what, this is just not for me, this is a bit boring, this is a bit dull, I don't know why anyone would want to get their ATPL and do this. But I think the landscape changed. You went from France across to Germany, and then you landed at your first stop, which was Saarbrücken.
That's right. And Saarbrücken sits in the Bavarian Mountains, in southern Germany. And actually, as you get nearer to that part of Germany, you can see the mountains rising up beneath you. And it all becomes a lot prettier. France, especially northern France, is quite flat, as many people who've flown there know. It's got lots of other good things going for it, of course, but the mountains isn't one of them. As you get into Germany, it all becomes a lot more varied from a terrain perspective.
Yeah. And what was Saarbrücken like? I mean, I know of it from other people's stories, but certainly not from a general aviation perspective. It didn't come across, I've never come across it in that aspect before. What was it like flying into? And
it was a bit of a disaster, to be honest with you, Peter.
Okay.
Somebody had told my friend that Saarbrücken was really GA friendly, and he sort of went with that recommendation. But we touched down, a handling agent came to greet us and said, first thing you need to do is you need to walk out of the airfield, then do a 180 and come back in, going through security where they will scan all of your things like you're boarding an airline.
To get
back onto the airside and to go to the sea, you know, the tower to pay your landing.
Yeah.
So that was our first sort of inkling that something was not quite right. We turned up outside security, and there was this really stern man there who said, I need to see the originals of your pilot's licenses.
Yeah.
To which we both said, well, they're back on the airplane.
Yeah.
To which he said, well, I can't let you anywhere near the airplane without the originals of your pilot's license. So that was a bit of a disaster. And then we did work it out in the end, got into the tower, paid our landing fee. And then I said, is there anywhere we can have a coffee, look at the charts for the next stage of flight, perhaps charge up our gadgets? To which the answer was no, there's nothing available.
So not very friendly.
Not very friendly really. At all. And I asked, can we do it in the tower? They said, no, absolutely not. This is forbidden. And then we were escorted back to the airplane by this really stern woman who sent us back to the airplane and said, do not leave. So we didn't.
Wow. Okay. To be fair, I've never talked to anyone who's flown too much GA in Germany. But for the few people that I do, and Markus Volta springs to mind, it always seems to be a relatively friendly place. So I was just quite surprised by that. But the other thing you saw at Saarbrücken was a lot of aircraft storage.
That's right. There's a corner of the airfield that looks a little bit like a flyby cemetery.
Right.
I really don't know how many of them there were, but quite a lot of airplanes in that livery, mostly turboprops. How long they will remain there, God alone knows.
We
all know that the world of airline business is rather unpredictable. I'm sure they won't throw it away there. I'm sure somebody will put them to good use, whether it'll be Flybe or somebody else. Your guess as well as mine.
Yeah, okay. Okay, so next stop was off from Saarbrücken to Poland, and I'm asking for your help in the name of the next stop, because I simply, as a rather dull and boring English person, I just can't pronounce it.
Oh, come on, give it a go, Peter.
By Gotschke?
The first letter was right, yes.
Okay.
Everything else less so. Bydgoszcz is how you pronounce
Bydgoszcz.
It.
Right. Okay. Mm. It's quite a big town. So that was your that was where you were flying to. But you decided to get out of Germany and hit a higher cruise level.
Yeah, so the plan was, again, for the same reasons we have discussed, efficiency, speed, fuel economy, we decided to go even higher. We decided to go at flight level 90, so 9,500 feet, really, on the QNH. And it really feels like being in an airliner. The visual picture of what you see when you look down through the clouds, it's really no different to what you see from 30,000 feet. Perhaps the horizon is closer in.
Sure.
But just visually, it's exactly what you'd see out of an airliner.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. I think when I was doing my PPL flying in America, I think the highest I went was maybe 6,500 feet. I mean, the aircraft was struggling, but I literally thought I was in an airliner. It's a funny visual illusion flying at that height without your heater, that did start to cause some problems.
It did. And with hindsight, maybe it wasn't the brightest of our ideas. Maybe we were getting a little bit tired. Because the outside air temperature was, I think, about +3, +4 at that height. And of course, it was warmer inside the cockpit, but we were both shivering. We were both really cold.
Yeah.
It wasn't much fun from that perspective.
You'd been flying for a good few hours at this time, hadn't you?
Yeah. So the first leg to Saarbrücken was about 3 hours, and it was a couple of hours into our second leg when we really started to feel the cold. So what, about 5 hours worth by that time?
It started to manifest itself in some of the behaviors, in some of your behaviors a little bit.
Well, I keep thinking about what it was. I certainly, towards the end of that leg, I certainly wasn't feeling quite right. I'd lost a fair bit of concentration. The mental arithmetic went out the window. I started getting my words, my radio calls, sort of slightly mumbled.
Yeah.
And then the really the lowest point was when I was switching tanks. Rather than going left, I very nearly went to fuel off past the D-tank.
Yeah.
So whether it was just because of the cold or whether it was the onset of hypoxia, I really don't know. I'm not a medic. I remember from, you know, we all know from theory courses we've done that you're supposed to be on oxygen around about the 10,000-12,000 foot mark.
Yeah.
We were at 9.5 on the QNH, but then we'd sat there for quite a few hours. And whether hypoxia is sort of cumulative like that, I don't really know. As soon as we got down into lower levels, just before Bydgoszcz, it all just went away and I started feeling so much better.
Yeah. And you got the landing.
That was, I got the last landing.
You got the last landing. Okay. So getting onto Bydgoszcz wasn't too bad. And you overnighted there, didn't you?
We did. It's a lovely, lovely place to spend the night, maybe more if you have the time.
Yeah.
We just found a hotel in town, you know, nothing fancy, just a acceptable hotel. I'd been to Bydgoszcz before for work. And I have to say, you know, there's really, if you wanted to see things and have a good time there, then there's stuff to be done there. We were both so tired that we had dinner at the hotel restaurant, which is something I never do, and just both collapsed in our rooms.
Yeah, okay. And what happens to the aircraft then? How do you secure it? Was there anything particular you had to do there and any customs challenges, anything like that?
Well, it's a big commercial airport, so you've got the Ryanair, the easy jets and all of that sort of stuff. They gave us a parking stand. We just left it there, and they gave us a lift to the terminal. I think we were probably on that particular day, we were probably the last airplane to arrive. So they were all just closing down and getting ready to go home, I think.
Yeah.
But yeah, there is this fairly large terminal, and I think we were the only two pilots in it at that point.
Right. Okay. One question I forgot to ask you, Artem, was the in Germany and in Poland, and then on to Lithuania. Was language ever a challenge for you? Because I know you speak a lot more languages than I do, but we all hear about the international language of flying is English. Is that the case?
Oh, absolutely. Certainly, if you're flying into big commercial airports like Saarbrücken, like Bydgoszcz, then yeah, 100%. Everybody speaks really good English. In fact, I would actually say that perhaps people in Poland spoke slightly better English than people in Germany. But at the end of the day, there was never a language barrier.
Yeah, okay. And when you got up the next morning, the weather had started to close in a little bit, hadn't it?
A little bit. It wasn't unflyable at all.
And yeah.
We could have gone VFR quite easily. Kastutis decided he wanted to go IFR just because, again, he could go higher like that.
Yeah.
Saving fuel and traveling faster, as discussed before. We were at 6,000 feet throughout, and we were in cloud throughout. I think the cloud base was maybe about 4,500, 5,000. So if we'd been a little bit lower than that, we would have been absolutely fine. From a VFR perspective. But I think one key lesson I've learned from that is if you're flying commercially, if you're flying the way professionals fly, then there's a different set of weather considerations that comes into play. For us, for people like you and I, and for your listeners, it's mostly cloud-based visibility, winds, all of that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Of course, they take it into account, but they also think about which is the most efficient height to fly at. Are there going to be any thunderstorms, perhaps long distance somewhere in the distance.
It's
just a different way of flying, really.
So you predominantly went IFR a little bit higher. Did that make it a little bit less interesting in terms of the handling? Put the autopilot on, go IFR.
Well, that's pretty much how we'd flown all the time.
The
autopilot was sorted by the time we took off from Leon Solent. We didn't risk it on the first leg, but then from the second leg onwards, from Saarbrücken onwards, it was autopilot all the way.
Right.
And really, my friend said that was how he likes to fly, because it means you don't really have to do a lot of work. You just sit there, relax, chat, have a banana, listen to some music, and all of those fun things. And he said that there's something that sort of stuck in my head a little bit when he said, this is the best way to fly. You're just sitting there doing nothing, and you can see the money going into your account.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, most of this flight has been pretty much autopilot driven.
Right. Okay. And it wasn't too long till you started your descent into, is it Kaunas?
Kaunas, yeah. I mean, the Lithuanians would say Kaunas.
Kaunas.
But I think in English we say Kaunas.
All right.
It was a really short leg, yeah, maybe a couple of hours.
Yeah, okay. And obviously that's slightly more familiar territory to you probably, but a question I did want to ask you is when I was looking at the map on your routing, I noticed quite how close you came to Kaliningrad. And of course, given the troubles in the world at the moment, I just wondered, were there any restrictions? Were there any challenges around that? Or were you so far away it wasn't an issue?
When you're flying in that part of the world, you are, of course, very, very keenly aware of of the issues. There's some danger areas, restricted areas along the border between Poland and Lithuania where you're not supposed to cross under a certain height. We were well above that height, so that wasn't really an issue for us. But we really wanted to be as far away from the Kaliningrad area as we could, if only because recently, according to Kastutis, who flies in that part of the world all the time, of course he lives there, only because recently the Russians have started jamming the GPS reception around that little corner of Europe.
Right.
And it's not really something you want, is it?
No. No.
So we did do a little bit of a detour. And yeah, you are sort of very aware of the fact that we're getting quite close to a country that doesn't really like us.
Yeah, sure. No, understand. So safely descending into Kaunas, and you got to do the landing.
I got the landing, and I mean, I have to say, 6 or 7 hours of staring at the autopilot and at the magenta line, it sort of dulls your senses a little bit. I think I'd forgotten to an extent just how heavy it is.
Yeah.
And it wasn't one of the best landings I've done, let's put it this way. If Kastutis hadn't intervened, I think we wouldn't have banned the aeroplane, but it wouldn't have been elegant, put it this way.
Yeah.
It
wouldn't
have been graceful. Because we, I mean, I don't know about the aeroplanes you fly, Peter, but in my...
Not time, anymore. I only sit in the back, the sides, or whatever, but not anymore. I've dropped out.
Oh, I see. Well, that's a shame. That's a shame. I must take you up. But
I'd love
back
to
the landing and that.
Yeah.
It's not finger precious. It's really both hands on the yoke and it's really pulling, which is just not something I do. In my flying.
Yeah.
There's an old saying, there's an old Russian saying, pilots are alive, therefore it was a successful flight. So there you go.
Right, okay. Yeah, understood. And the other thing I wanted to ask you about flying the Saratoga was it heavy on the feet as well? Do you use a lot of rudder? Was it quite stable that way?
Not really. I think with most aeroplanes like that, rudder is a lot less of an issue than it is in...
Yeah,
smaller aeroplanes. It's not very ruddery at all. The one thing I did notice was that on the ground, when you're taxiing it, it is very, very, very heavy on the rudders because the rudders on that aeroplane are directly connected to the nose wheel.
Yeah,
and you're trying to turn the nose wheel against the tarmac, and there's a weight of a 2-ton aeroplane pressing down on it. So
yeah,
you can really feel how heavy it is.
Yeah. So the aircraft's 2 tons. You flew 1,500 miles. You burn half a ton of fuel, something like that?
Yeah, something like that. I think generally it worked out for us at about 15, 16 gallons an hour.
Yeah.
And that is cruising at about 140, 150 knots.
Right,
through airspeed.
And can I ask how much that the fuel bill for a flight like that would be, you know, from Leon Solent to...
You know, because I was doing the admin, I had collected all the receipts for the lucky owner because, of course, he...
Yeah, sure.
So the receipts for the fuel, the handling, the landing fees, the hotel in Bydgoszcz, the hotel in Bydgoszcz, all of that came to about 2,300 euros, roughly.
Okay.
Very roughly.
Okay. All right. Quite interesting. And was the customer happy to get his aeroplane, her aeroplane?
So. You know, we didn't actually see him for some reason. He couldn't be there when we arrived. So his agents were there. Two young guys who crawled all over the aeroplane, inspected every little, you know, nook and cranny. And they seemed to be happy.
So outside of the... I'm sure when you got out, you must have just felt so good. You must have felt so proud of yourself for doing that.
I did feel very good. I wouldn't say I felt proud of myself because really I hadn't done that much.
Okay.
You know, the handling part of that flight, the operation of the controls, wasn't really that big a factor. It was mostly flown on autopilot.
Yeah.
And I wasn't the one who did the plan. I wasn't the one who came up with the weather ideas and with, you know, all the planning.
You're very understated, though, Artyom. I know you put a lot of effort into this, so I won't put you on the spot anymore. But what I will ask you for, and what the sort of lessons, as just as a pilot, an enthusiast, you know, what were the sort of lessons that you took from that adventure?
I think to me the biggest lesson is just how varied hobby, industry, passion, whatever you want to call it, how varied it is. The fact that the Saratoga was so vastly different from the aeroplanes I normally fly, doesn't make it better or worse.
Yeah.
It's just different. And you have to respect that. You have to be aware of that and you have to be sort of awake a little bit.
Yeah.
Don't try and land a heavy aeroplane with your fingertips. That's not going to work out. I think the other important lesson was that when you look at the map or when you look at your Sky Demon screen or four-flight screen, a flight like this may look very daunting and it may look like something that, you know, oh, God, how can I really fly my Cessna 152 from the UK to the other end of Europe. Well, actually, you can. And actually, yeah. If you plan it right and if you don't do anything silly with the weather and with your fuel planning and things like that, then really it's just like doing a flight from Leon Solon to Popham, except doing it a little bit more times.
It certainly got my imagination running, and I'm really, really grateful that you've shared that story with us. Where can we find you online? Are you on social media at all?
You can find me on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, and all the other usual places. Not on Twitter anymore.
Okay.
But yeah, on Facebook, you can find me in the UK Private Pilots group. You can find my personal profile there. And then also Instagram, LinkedIn, and all the other fun bits.
Okay. Well, we'll put links to those in the show notes so that people can follow you. And just before we finish, just to apologize a little bit to the listeners for indulging us in the background noise while we enjoy a little bit of liquid refreshment. So I hope that didn't interfere too much, but I think it added a little atmosphere to it. So Artyom, thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you. It was really good fun.
So that's it. We'd like to thank White Hearts as well as the wider extended family of supporters, including, of course, Mick Oakey at the Aviation Historian and Simon Jakubowski at the Aviation Enthusiasts Book Club. We know you're busy, but thousands of you listen in, and we'd love to get your feedback either on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or on your podcast player. It helps us grow. And after we lost a whole bunch of subscribers last year due to a technical issue, we need those reviews. So please keep them coming in. You can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter, and you can find Tim, Gareth and Ellie on the extended Twitter, Facebook and Instagram feeds. That's it with the arrival of the music. It's goodbye from Artyom.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme's produced with a Creative Commons licence.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our programme and broaden its reach. You can also review the programme and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of Extended.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Extend it!
This is XTP Media.